Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoeffer of Northwestern University. The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it. We gratefully acknowledge contributions to sustain the Infrastructure Show from Andrea and Ron DeFeo, Dr. Robert Peskin, and Dr. Raymond Ellis. There's much talk about public-private partnerships, or P3s, to advance, to fund, and to generate public infrastructure projects. Can private money solve the U.S. infrastructure problem? What are the realistic roles for private interest in infrastructure investment and improvement? To help us understand P3s and private infrastructure interests, we're talking with David Pennington, who is Managing Director at BMO Capital Markets, who has advised both public and private entities on the financial considerations of major transportation infrastructure projects. David, we're very happy to be talking to you today.
It's great to join you today. Thanks.
You've talked about P3s as mechanisms for risk sharing in infrastructure projects. Can you explain how that works?
Okay. Probably useful to sort of think about a P3 project as being a risk transfer exercise. And usually where you see the risk transfer is in the construction and in the operating period. P3s encompass a whole bunch of different potential structures, but generally when people are talking about P3s, they're talking about two specific structures. One, the availability structure, often called the DBFOM. Effectively what happens is the government contracts out with a concessionaire. The concessionaire is responsible for building the asset and then operating it over time, and then at the end of the operations period, they return it back to the original owner, typically some form of government entity. And the risk transfer ultimately comes from the fact that the government owner is effectively contracting for the service, if you like, and not for the asset itself. And so there's a whole set of requirements that the concessionaire is required to reach. And so the risk transfer is the concessionaire is now taking completion risk and that they have to finish it within a certain amount of time. They're taking financing risk. They have the responsibility to go and find the money in order to build it. And then during the operating period, they're responsible for O&M risk, you know, ultimately operating the asset and delivering the service, and as well for life cycle, for maintaining the asset so it's in good shape when they eventually return it back to the government authority, at which point the government authority might then recontract it again. And that's the structure that we would see both in what I would call a vertical or a social infrastructure, like a courthouse, for example, or in horizontal infrastructure like a road or a transit system or something like that. The other model, if you like, which is very similar but is a revenue model, that one would be you're paying an availability payment. You're paying for the service. It's almost like a lease payment plus an O&M payment or a return of capital. In a revenue model, which is probably the one that people are most used to when people think about P3s, is a toll road, for example, where instead of the government paying the entity to operate the asset, which you kind of have to do with something like a courthouse where there's no source of revenue, in that case, you add the additional risk in that the concessionaire is taking volume risk or price risk or revenue risk, depending on what you want to call it. And in that case, if there's a sufficient amount of traffic, then the entity will probably be able to pay for all of that with their future traffic revenue, which they borrow against. Or alternatively, if it's insufficient, there might be a subsidy stream for the government to make it work. And if it's a significantly advantageous economically, there might even be an opportunity for that concessionaire to pay the government a lump sum payment, which the government can then sort of go and spend on something else in the future. So again, it's the risk transfer appears in a number of different places. It comes in the financing risk, it comes in the operating risk, it comes in the construction completion and cost risk, and then it comes back in what I would call handback risk or life cycle risk.
Generally speaking, in the horizontal example, if you're looking at a revenue generating facility, in most cases, is the private investor expecting all the revenue to come back from the facility itself, or is there a safety feature that protects them from loss?
There's a number of models that we've seen over time. And a lot of it's ultimately driven by the view on what they think the traffic is going to be, which is often the traffic study. So as part of a process, when you're doing a revenue deal, there's usually a third-party consultant but that both sides hire that sort of tries to estimate what future traffic will be. And if the view is, if the traffic's robust enough and the demand inelastic enough, the expectation is the toll that will be collected will be sufficient to pay for the asset, and so there won't really be any need for any government money. But we've also seen models where there's some concern that the volume at the front end may not be enough, and so the government might offer sort of a floor to the amount of revenue for the other entity to make sure that they participate. We've also seen it done financially. If you're familiar with the TIFIA program, one of the things that the TIFIA program, which is one of the things the federal government offers, one of the reasons it existed originally is it's a subordinated revenue piece such that it helps to protect the senior lenders from that first loss where revenue might not turn out in the front end as much as they think. As a result, default, it's almost like the TIFIA piece absorbs the first loss before it moves on to the other lenders. So you have this ability to attract the cheaper lender money to come into the process. So again, we've seen it from both sides. The government entity might provide the projection. You might get the protection for the lenders, who generally are the significant portion of the financing of these things. It's not the equity that's the largest piece, but the lenders, you protect them by putting a subordinated or a buffer piece of capital in between.
As I understand what you just described, there are cases where the private investor says, no, I won't take the revenue risk, and I need the public entity to take that. I need to get paid.
Right. You can almost think of it as a continuum. At the far end of the continuum where they say, I'm not taking any revenue risk, ultimately then the payment stream turns into availability payment. And it's effectively, you get paid for constructing and operating it, and you're not taking any revenue risk. You know, example of that is the Ohio River Bridges transaction that was done a few years ago. So over the Ohio River, it's between Indiana and Kentucky. The bridge itself will be tolled, is our understanding, but the payment stream that's going to the contractor or the developer or the concessionaire, whatever you want to call them, will be basically done on a flat basis. They bid the amount that they're going to get paid over the next 30 years. There's a little bit of an escalation for inflation, but ultimately, if there's one car or there's a million cars over the bridge, they get paid exactly the same amount.
And the public entity takes the toll.
The public entity takes the toll risk.
That's sort of like what was done in Denver for the Easton Gold Line, the line that goes to the airport, as I recall. That is, the concessionaire wouldn't take the revenue risk.
Yeah, it's often the case when it's pure greenfield. It's never been built before. There's no existing traffic. It's not an upgrade. It's not a congestion relief that the concessionaire is uncomfortable with taking the toll risk. Like any other financial transaction, it might be that they're willing to take it, but the government entity isn't willing to pay them the premium it would cost for them to take that additional risk. It's just too expensive for them to take the risk in two ways. One, it's politically expensive, and the other one is potentially if things work out, well, that entity is going to make a windfall gain, which is difficult for governments to take. So again, there's a number of different reasons why. It might be a very successful road, and the government still doesn't want to pass along the revenue risk because they don't want to give someone a windfall. There's some political consideration. So again, every transaction is structured to meet both economic objectives and policy objectives for the government entity. And the format's flexible enough because it's contractual to do both things. So, you know, exactly the same asset might be financed and structured and contracted differently depending on what government entity is managing and what their outcome is or what outcome they want to get.
I want to take you back to the brownfield, greenfield example, because as I understand it, what's special about the greenfield case is you cannot see the demand because there's nothing there. Whereas you can, in the case of a brownfield, at least you know that there's some activity there and you can extrapolate off of that.
Yeah, it's more complex. And again, it's like anything else. It ebbs and flows over time. As markets get better, people are willing to take more risk. And as well, if people are comfortable with the traffic study, they might take more of the greenfield risk. But again, it all comes back to the equity, as you would expect. It's a higher return, will take more risk. But the debt holders have to be comfortable that there's sufficient revenue to cover their fixed cost, their fixed P&I, principal and interest cost. So from an expectation, the lenders look at the traffic study and go, you know, is there enough money to pay me over time? Is it coming soon enough for it to cover this requirement that I'm going to create over time? And if it's not, what happens ultimately is you have to put more equity in because equity doesn't need to be serviced. It eventually has to make a return, but you don't have to service it. It's not like debt. But again, once you start taking debt out and put more equity in, it becomes more expensive. And so there comes a point where there's a trade-off between how much equity it is and how much debt it is and what the relative cost is in order to service that capital. So what you'll generally see, particularly in recent times, is there was some issues historically with traffic studies being really good at predicting what happens with a greenfield asset. So we're in this sort of mode where lenders are less likely to give you money based on a traffic study for greenfield because they're uncomfortable that it's going to be correct. On a brownfield asset, there's a significant amount of comfort, and you see some very, very aggressive bids under a transaction.
We're familiar with the research literature, which shows a pattern of massive forecasting errors, particularly in the greenfield cases, optimistic errors, demand predicted too high, cost predicted too low. Beyond avoiding those kinds of high-risk situations, are there things that you can do or that your clients can do in the forecasting process to manage down some of that risk?
Kim, I have clients on both sides, so it's a bit of government side and a bit of private sectors. Some of it is to make sure that entity who's doing your traffic study is spending the time to do it properly. The other thing, if you think about it from that third-party lender's perspective, who actually has no skin in the game, they're just lending, they spend a lot of time checking on independence. to make sure that that traffic study isn't overly optimistic because the concessionaire wants it overly optimistic because they want to do a deal. So that's important as well. You know, and as I said, the trend has generally moved away from the expectation that you can really clearly forecast greenfield assets. And so there's generally been a push to not finance those on a revenue risk basis and do them on another basis. If there really is a need for it and the government thinks there is a need for it, they might just do it on their own balance sheet. In other words, do it as an availability payment instead of trying to do it as a revenue risk payment.
I've heard people in the industry talk about something called an investment grade forecast. Is there really such a thing, or is it just, well, we're going to do a little bit better job?
It's a bit of a marketing feature. But the way I would look at it, it's exactly as you described it. An investment-grade traffic study is one where they've spent a significant amount of additional effort, and effort is cost. You have people going out and doing interviews. You have people sitting there for days on end studying the traffic. You do input and output surveys. You do potentially some more econometrics or sort of more drill down into the local economy. So there's more work that gets done, so it's more expensive. But like anything else where you're predicting the future, it'll never be perfect. You've just potentially mitigated a number of the other potential risks. But it's a little bit of trying to predict what individual human beings are going to do, and that's not always possible. Human beings have a tendency to do what they want, and it's not always predictable, whether it's traffic or whether it's financial markets.
Then there have been failures. There have been some bankruptcies and some write-downs of assets. I'm curious about that because as a non-financial person, it strikes me that that kind of failure is really a survival mechanism for investors. It's a way of getting out without dying.
Yeah, the way I would look at it too is that the Chicago assets are an interesting one, the Chicago Skyway and the Indiana Toll Road, both which were done pre-crisis, had traffic studies done. At the time, everyone thought everything was fine, but ultimately it didn't play out. And so both the assets went through a process where they were repriced. Some of the debt was written down or debt was replaced by equity, but effectively from a perspective, an insolvency event of some kind. But if you look at it from the owner's perspective, the equity, the concessionaire, that was a downside risk. That was a failure. But if you look at it from the government perspective, that potentially means those entities overpaid them. And so it's an upside. If they had kept them, they would have made less money than if they had sold them. So you see both sides of it. We hear a lot from government saying, oh, well, you know, I don't want a failure where the asset I sell went bankrupt. We always try to sort of remind them that, well, if it went bankrupt, that means someone paid you more for that asset than it's worth. On the other side, part of the reason why investors make investments is to take risk. So there's an expectation that if there's an upside in an asset, well, then, of course, there's got to be some kind of downside. Now, in an infrastructure asset where the downside is relatively low, availability payment being a classic one, well, the upside's also pretty low, and so the IRR they're expecting is lower. So generally where you're going to see entities deal with these issues, these investors deal with these issues, if they think there's a lot of risk in a project, they're going to expect a higher return in terms of how they bid it.
Is there talk in the industry about addressing what I might call massive risks associated with changes in technology, service modalities, customer values, for example, the ride matching services, which really popped up on the horizon very rapidly, or changes in retailing or consumer values?
Most of these contracts have structure in them that there are certain kinds of risks, particularly the ones that the government has control over, that are kept with the government. The classic one is if you're getting a toll road concession for a period of time, the contract usually says, well, the government can't build a free road right next door or they have to compensate you. So those are usually included. There's also generally a section about discriminatory legal changes where they specifically create a law to make it more expensive, and those are generally compensatable events. But other than that, a lot of the risks, particularly on revenue deals, are part of the cost of doing business. Whether it's autonomous vehicles, or reducing your total volume, or changing patterns of demographics where people are leaving the city, those are usually embedded in the risk profile of the transaction. So it's also one of those things that the traffic study is supposed to try to capture. There's not a lot of very specific things that people look at to say, you know, that's a risk that I'm really worried about, and therefore I'm not going to do this particular transaction. If it's a big enough risk, no one's going to do the transaction. If it's a manageable risk, you deal with it as part of your investment profile. You sort of assume that there are kinds of risks. You insure the ones you can. You try to make enough money such that you can absorb some of the downside risks of the ones you can't.
Where is the money coming from for all of these projects?
Yeah, for a toll road, the money's coming from the users of the toll road. And for example, I did one in Ontario. Actually, it's been done twice now where it's a driver examination services concession. Actually, there's one in the UK that I think is with passports. So it's basically they make the money by teenagers showing up at the door and saying, okay, well, here's my fee for taking my driver's test, and that sort of runs the business. So there's a whole segment of these transactions where, as I said, the revenue risk and the payment stream is coming from the fact that you've got a customer who's using the asset and they're paying you for it, almost like a utility.
What about the upfront money, the money to build, say, a tollway or a toll road or a bridge?
It's the two entities, the two capital supplying entities. It's the concessionaire brings equity. Often the concessionaire isn't a single entity. It's a consortium who owns that concessionaire. Often the contractor and private equity infrastructure fund of some kind. And so they'll provide a portion of the capital, if you like, the equity capital. The balance of the capital will come from a lender. In the case of U.S. toll roads, more often than not, that lender is a private activity bond, municipal tax-exempt bond that's done under federal rules that allow it to be done on a tax-exempt basis. Other jurisdictions outside of the U.S., municipal bonds don't exist. Sometimes, like in historically, it was sometimes a bank who were lending long terms, but these days, most of the time, the lender is a long-term fixed-rate lender, insurance companies being sort of the most frequent investors in these transactions, but as well, there's specialized funds that do infrastructure and financing. So almost every transaction has an equity piece and a debt piece, and the equity piece is almost always supplied by the bidder, the entity that's managing the transaction, and the debt piece is usually obtained from the capital markets from third parties.
And it looks to me like the Australian banks have been particularly active in this market.
The Australian investment banks, for example, the Macquaries of the world, have been very, very active on the advisory side. The Australian, I would call them pension and insurance entities, have been very active on the investment side, the IFMs of the world, for example. And so we've seen them in the equity. There is an Australian entity, and Transurban is sort of another one of those that you're going to see, more of a listed versus an insurance company. So very, very active on the equity side. You generally don't see them in the debt bucket. A couple of those entities, IFM, AMP, have specialized infrastructure debt funds. But the largest players, quite honestly, in the U.S. particularly, on the debt side, are almost exclusively municipal bond buyers. You and me and our municipal bond funds, in effect.
Yeah, so that risk is spread broadly.
Yeah, it's just another asset. We could be buying a private activity bond for a road, or we could be buying a bond in a healthcare facility, or we could buy a bond in a utility. They're fungible in terms of what they go into a portfolio and they get spread between various investors, as you suggest, and they're tax exempt. They have some advantages because of that.
Looking forward, can we really make a dent in the infrastructure problem in the United States without significant federal dollars?
We have a lot of conversations about P3 being a solution. And P3s are great for mitigating risk and moving risks from the government to other parties. They're great for finding capital to finance things from third parties, but they don't provide funding. There are certain small segments, and you won't necessarily say toll roads are small segments, but ultimately toll roads are a small segment of the total infrastructure package the government is expected to supply by the populace. And so unless it's an asset that, like a toll road that self-finances, someone needs to pay the bill. A courthouse, school, even a transit system. You know, all of those things are not going to self-finance. So where does the money come from? And so ultimately, the money has to come from a government entity. The private sector isn't going to provide the funding. They're happy to lend you the money and invest the money in order to build the asset, but they have to make it back over time. And if there is sufficient revenue to make it back over time, it has to come from a government entity. There has to be a subsidy stream somewhere. And so then the question is it coming from a municipal entity, is it coming from a state entity, or is it coming from a federal entity? And it can come from any of the three. And to say, well, it's the federal government, then it just comes down to a question of who's collecting the taxes ultimately that they're going to pay for these assets. Or there's been a lot of discussion about recycling. If you're not going to tax, well, then you have to go find an asset. For example, a toll road being a classic example, that you've been running it for a bunch of years, it's worth a big amount of money. You sell that asset, and that creates the money to do the next issue. So in effect, you're selling old assets to build new ones. That's certainly one of your strategies. But ultimately, if you go through it, infrastructure needs cash. It's like anything else, like buying a house, buying furniture on installment. You're effectively buying something that has value over multiple years, and you have to pay for it now, but you got to repay it for it over time.
So I can't get somebody else to pay for it. Ultimately, we need to close the financial loop and pay for that asset.
Yeah, unless it's self-financing, or unless you create a structure where everything has a fee attached. It's not a panacea that will solve a bunch of problems related to funding. Like, ultimately, the cash has to come from somewhere.
The risk sharing and financing, that's what we need to focus on.
Yeah, and there are some advantages. Other ways that we've seen P3s used is courthouses are a classic example where in many jurisdictions there's a requirement to have a courthouse, but you also have to go to the populace and get them to vote on it and say, okay, well, I want to spend $300 million on a courthouse. The populace says, no, I don't want you to bond. You know, I don't want you to go and raise money for this courthouse. And so then you're stuck with, you sort of have a statutory requirement to provide a courthouse, but you have no ability to fund it. That's one of the things that P3s can do. Someone else funds it and you just pay it like you would as if you were paying a lease stream.
Yes, it really becomes a lease.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you want to think about it, it's a lease that has a lot more teeth to it. If they do a bad job of it, you terminate them. If they aren't performing, you penalize them and you take money away from the lease. It's kind of like a lease plus.
In any case, it's a lease with strong requirements in it.
Yeah.
David, thank you very much. This has been extremely enlightening. I really appreciate your spending the time with us. You've taught us a lot about finance and P3s and give us some insights in how things work. So thanks for spending the time with us today.
Appreciate the call. Happy to do it anytime.
Bye.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to The Infrastructure Show. If you enjoyed the conversation as much as we did, please encourage your friends to subscribe to our podcast. The Infrastructure Show is recorded in the Reeves Audio Recording Studios in Evanston, Illinois, under the direction of Jim Reeves, Chief Engineer, with a commitment to great sound. Our producer is Marion Sowers, a journalist with a passion for infrastructure. And I am Professor Joseph Schoeffer. Few people are more curious about infrastructure than I am.